foreign ministers of Iran and Saudi Arabia agreed to meet in the coming days as the two Persian Gulf countries take another step towards fully restoring ties. The Israeli regime has authorized the formation of a settler militia proposed by far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir to deal with Palestinian resistance groups. And a bomb blast in Russia's second-largest city of St. Petersburg has killed a well-known military blogger. Thank you for joining us. Now, our top story this hour, Iran and Saudi Arabia are moving quickly to build on their recent rapprochement. Their respective foreign ministers have now agreed to meet in the upcoming days. The agreement came during a spate of recent phone calls between the two top diplomats. The Iranian foreign minister expressed satisfaction with the positive trend in bilateral relations. Hossein Abdullahian underscored Iran's determination to expand its policy of good neighborly relations. The Saudi foreign minister also hailed the current direction of bilateral ties. Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud stressed the need for regular meetings and contact between the two countries' officials. Iran and Saudi Arabia signed a Chinese brokered deal last month to normalize relations 7 years after they were severed. They agreed to reopen their diplomatic missions within 2 months after signing the deal. Saudi Arabia is planning to invite the Syrian president to an upcoming Arab League summit in Riyadh amid ongoing rapprochement efforts between regional states and Damascus. Reuters has cited informed sources as saying that Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan will travel to Damascus in the coming weeks to hand over a formal invitation to Bashar al-Assad. Syria was suspended from the 22-member Arab League after a foreign-backed insurgency and a war gripped the nation in 2011. The Saudi plan would formally end Syria's regional isolation. The two countries have also agreed to reopen embassies in each other's capital after the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The United Arab Emirates and Egypt are among other Arab states that have recently signaled the resumption of diplomatic ties with Damascus. Our Damascus correspondent Mohammed Ali joined us earlier with details on Saudi Arabia's plans to invite the Syrian president to an upcoming Arab League summit in Riyadh.
Now, all that comes just amid talks that are happening between both sides, the Syrian side and the Saudi side, on the level of the foreign ministry, perhaps, and the security level, with regards to reopening the embassies, the Saudi embassy and the Syrian embassy in both countries. Saudi Arabia previously announced that it plans to resume consular services in Syria. Definitely, this is a very significant development. However, we have to wait and see if the Syrian side, if the Syrian president will accept to attend that summit. Now, we know that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian officials in general previously made it clear in the past couple of 2 months that the case is not about Syria attending Arab League summits. It's about activating joint Arab action. And in order for the Arab League to meetings to result in perhaps positive results for the benefit of the region, there should be first good relations, bilateral relations among Arab countries in general. So perhaps this is what is happening. First, restoring normal relations between Syria and Arab countries in particular, and then perhaps that Arab League summit would be fruitful. This is how the Syrian government looks at the issue and considers the issue.
Syria's deputy foreign minister has arrived with a delegation in Moscow to attend a quadrilateral meeting between Russia, Syria, Iran, and Turkey. Before his departure, Ayman Sosen said that he would hold separate bilateral talks with Russia and Iran on Monday. The four-way foreign ministerial meeting is scheduled for Tuesday. Sosan underlined that his focus would be on ending Turkey's military presence in Syria. He said combating terrorism and non-interference in Syria's internal affairs are also on the agenda. Russia and Iran want the reconciliation between Turkey and Syria. Russia hosted Syrian and Turkish defense ministers in December. The tripartite talks later widened to include Iran. Turkey sent its forces into northern Syria and launched cross-border operations under the pretext of fighting terrorists. But Damascus has repeatedly condemned the Turkish presence on its soil and accuses Turkey of supporting terror groups. Elsewhere, the Israeli cabinet has authorized setting up a so-called National Guard proposed by far-right Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir to deal with Palestinian resistance groups. A statement from the Prime Minister's office says a committee comprised of different agencies would submit their recommendation on the new force within 90 days. It was not immediately clear who would have direct authority over the force, but Benjamin Netanyahu's political rivals have accused him of setting up a, quote, sectarian militia. Israel's police chief, in a letter to Ben-Gvir, has also expressed misgivings about the plan. Ben-Gvir has been on the forefront of supporting terrorism and incitement against the Palestinians. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, condemned Israel's plan to form the settler militia. Hamas said the move is to intensify the crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied territories. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says one of its officers has died of wounds sustained in a recent Israeli attack on Syria. This brings to two the number of Iranian military advisors killed in Friday's Israeli airstrikes near the Syrian capital Damascus. The IRGC says the Israeli regime's crimes won't go unanswered. Iran has deployed its military advisors to Syria upon the invitation of the Syrian government to help fight terror groups. Iran says the international community's failure to give a deterrent response has emboldened Israel to keep violating Syria's territorial integrity and sovereignty. Iran's navy says it has warned off a U.S. spy plane that violated the country's airspace close to the Sea of Oman. The Iranian Navy says its forces acted with full vigilance and that the warning forced the plane to return to international airspace. The aircraft in question was a Lockheed F-3E spy plane operated by the U.S. Navy. Iranian military officials have repeatedly declared their readiness to protect the country's borders. In recent years, Iranian forces have on several occasions intercepted and warned off or chased off intruding U.S. aircraft and warships in waters south of the country. In 2019, Iran shot down a U.S. spy drone over its airspace. Tehran says U.S. forces in the region are a source of tension and instability and must leave. In other news, Burkina Faso's military government continues cracking down on media and reporters from the country's former colonial master, France. The junta running the African country has expelled two women correspondents from Le Monde and Liberation Dailies. The junta has not cited any reason, but Le Monde denounced the move as arbitrary and unacceptable. Recently, Burkina Faso also suspended France 24 broadcasts after the channel aired an interview with an Al-Qaeda leader. In December, it also suspended Radio France Internationale, accusing it of airing a message of intimidation attributed to a terrorist chief. Earlier this year, France ended its military presence in Burkina Faso following the government's demand and amid growing anti-French sentiments in the country. Farai Mvuti from London-based Southern African Times joined us earlier with his take on Burkina Faso's actions against French reporters and broadcasters.
the government has been quite careful in as far as messaging is concerned, because the regional conflict, as you are aware, especially within Sahel, and the continued attacks and the security crisis have further escalated. And naturally, during a war, I think it's incumbent on any country to try and control and contain its messaging. And this is not quite new, and it's not unique to Burkina Faso, by the way. If you consider the fact that when the Russia military operation in Ukraine began, which of course is now deemed to be and defined as a war, establishments governments such as the UK expelled Russia because of messaging, as is the case in America. So I don't think it's particularly unique to Burkina Faso, especially when faced with a security concern, that the government would act this way. However, there are, of course, reports of independent journalists that equally have felt that they have been unfairly treated and unduly so to do their job effectively. But of course, this has to be looked at from a very nuanced perspective and not a generalistic approach to merely defining it as just a crackdown on media.
A well-known Russian military blogger has died in an explosion that ripped through a cafe in St. Petersburg. Russia's Interior Ministry has confirmed the death of Vladimir Tatarsky, whose real name was Maxim Forman, and had over 500,000 followers on Telegram. Some 16 people were also injured in the blast caused by an explosive device. Tatarsky will often provided a critical running commentary on the war in Ukraine. A source says the explosive was placed in a gift box sent to the blogger. It was not immediately clear who was responsible. This is the second assassination on Russian soil of a figure associated with the war in Ukraine. Last August, the daughter of an ultra-nationalist was killed in a car bomb attack near Moscow. Russia's Federal Security Service had blamed Ukraine for Daria Dugina's killing, but Kiev denied its involvement. Russia has adopted a new foreign policy doctrine, prioritizing the elimination of what it calls Western dominance in global politics. The 42-page document presented by the Russian foreign minister and signed by President Vladimir Putin sets a new global approach given what Russia sees as existential threats to its security.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed off on a new foreign policy strategy aimed at prioritizing the elimination of what it calls Western dominance in global politics. Addressing members of the Russian Security Council via video link, Putin said,
"Cardinal changes in international life have forced us to seriously adjust key strategic planning documents, including the foreign policy concept of the Russian Federation, which outlines the principles, tasks, priorities of diplomatic activity."
The Russian leader explained that the key document had to be altered due to what he termed as drastic changes in the international landscape. The new foreign policy outlines how Russia could take, quote, symmetrical and asymmetric measures in response to unfriendly actions against it. The 42-page document says to build a multipolar world, Russia would create conditions to counter any new colonial and hegemonic ambitions. The document was presented by Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who in a televised address said Russia faces existential threats to its security.
"The existential nature of threats to the security and development of our country driven by the actions of unfriendly states is recognized in Russia's new foreign policy."
Lavrov said the United States of America is directly named as the main initiator and conductor of anti-Russia sentiment, and in general, the policy of the West aimed at weakening Russia in every possible way is characterized as a hybrid war of a new kind. He said that anti-Russia measures include undermining its military, economic, and technological potentials, as well as aiming to limit its sovereignty in external and internal politics to erode its territorial integrity. Lavrov underlined that Moscow will no longer rely on the West for energy trade and instead will shift its business toward China and India. The top diplomat's comments came as Moscow has voiced its readiness to maintain its strategic parity and peaceful coexistence with the United States and establish a balance of interest between the two. Nevertheless, the new policy document has made it clear that the prospect of such relations largely depends on the U.S. abandoning its domineering stance and giving emphasis on interactions with Russia. Moscow says it expects Western powers to recognize the futility of confrontational policies and hegemonic ambitions and to eventually return to pragmatic cooperation with Russia. Russia has clearly stressed that mutual respect should be the basis for dialogue and cooperation.
Adopting the new policy strategy by Russia comes at a time when Moscow, Beijing, and New Delhi are joining hands to create a new global order. But will the coalition of the three, along with other countries in the Eastern Bloc, pave the way for a new multipolar world?
Russia's new strategy package has stressed the need for boosting cooperation with China and India. It calls for the deepening of ties and cooperation with friendly sovereign global centers of power and development located on the Eurasian continent. Moscow has already stepped up energy supplies to both China and India after being almost entirely cut off from its traditional European markets. However, Russia's new policy document can also be seen in light of Chinese President Xi Jinping's recent visit to Moscow. Undoubtedly, China and Russia share a common concern about the West that has been trying to isolate the two countries from East and West Asia, Europe to Africa under different pretexts. Russia has time and again warned the US-led NATO against its eastward expansion, calling it an existential threat. Ironically, that was one of the reasons of Moscow's military offensive against Ukraine. In West Asia, the U.S. continues to maintain its presence by deploying troops to the countries like Iraq and Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But its military adventurism is to instill fear among regional countries and to serve as a goal to encircle Russia. In East Asia, China has long accused the United States of trying to create what it calls Indo-Pacific NATO by signing a string of defense agreements from the Philippines to Australia. From the military buildup on the Korean Peninsula to providing military assistance to Taiwan by the U.S. and its allies, it seems that Putin's argument about the West's attempt to create a global axis is closer to reality. Instances like China broke a diplomatic rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Russia's move to stop the West's expansionism, are enough to suggest the need of a multipolar world order. This is something countries were deprived of due to the U.S. intentions to make a unipolar world to pursue its own agenda. But a change is taking place given that many countries like Russia, China, and India have proved themselves to be able to shift the global order.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadarbat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
At least 40 people at an immigration detention center in a Mexican city on the U.S. border died in a fire that broke out at the facility overnight, according to a statement issued by the center known as the National Immigration Institute, INM. One immigrant advocate said in this regard, "This tragedy is the direct result of the United States of America's immigration system." In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Throughout wrote in this regard, more than 36 asylum seekers were killed in a fire at a migrant jail in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, recently. At least 39 people imprisoned at the jail were killed by the fire, which took place overnight. The Mexican Instituto Nacional de Migración, INM, said in a statement. Another 29 people were injured, some of whom are in critical condition. Victims were transferred to at least 4 hospitals in the area. Isa Noyola, deputy director of Migenet, told Truth Out, "The fire at the shelter is a devastating tragedy and a reminder of how border and immigration policies are shaping and intensifying a crisis of fear that fuels a greater disparity and loss of human lives. Unfortunately, we will continue to see more and more tragedies unfold along both sides of the border as long as the U.S. and Mexican governments continue to play into fear-based politics that promote the idea that migrants are disposable," Noyola added. "Now more than ever, the U.S. government must be held accountable for the devastation along the border and human rights violations in detention centers." Al Jazeera described the fire as one of the deadliest incidents at an immigration lockup in the country. Video of the incident shows ambulances and fire response crews arriving at the scene, with vans from the morgue arriving shortly after. The victims of the fire had traveled from Central and South America to seek asylum in the United States. Mexico's Attorney General's office had launched an inquiry into the fire. Initial reports from Mexican officials blamed migrants, claiming they sparked the fire in protest of their looming deportation. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is often referred to as AMLO, said in a statement, "In the door of the shelter, they put some mattresses and set them on fire. They never imagined that would cause this tragedy." AMLO was widely condemned for failing to address the conditions of the jail, which likely played a role in the number of lives lost, or the militarized immigration systems of Mexico and the United States. What officials must explain is what conditions the detention center was in, such that they had not been able to save 39 people from being trapped while it was on fire, labor lawyer Francisco I. Kalanga said on Twitter. Charles Dauverger, a former employee at Mexico's Human Rights Commission, who spent 10 years monitoring migrant jails, has publicly questioned the government narrative that migrants started the fire. Many immigrant advocates have noted that the tragedy is largely the result of decades of violent U.S. border policing. The true culprit of this horrific fire is the Biden administration, which has obliterated the right to asylum, barred U.S. entry to asylum seekers, and kept tens of thousands of camped in unsafe conditions like this to deter migration, said Eric London, a writer for the World Socialist website AMLO2, Open the Borders. Silky Shah, executive director of Detention Watch Network, told Truthout that immigrant jails are inherently harmful, abusive, and unjust, no matter where they are located, and that, in the most tragic cases, they are deadly, she added. This tragedy is the direct result of the United States immigration system, which has prioritized deterrence, detention, and militarization over humanity at every step. The U.S. and Mexican governments are morally complicit in the abuse and death that people migrating for safety face once they arrive at the southern border. In February, the Biden administration proposed a rule that would require asylum seekers at the U.S. border, many of whom are fleeing gang violence, systematic poverty, or government persecution, to first apply for asylum in countries they pass through on their way to the U.S. Under this policy, which is expected to be implemented in May, migrants from Central or South America who do not seek asylum in Mexico before reaching the U.S. border will be subject to immediate deportation. Immigrant advocates have said that the proposal resembles asylum bans pursued by former President Donald Trump. The United Nations has urged President Biden to rescind the plan, noting that the policy will result in the forced return of people to situations where their lives and safety would be at risk, which is prohibited under international law. Borders Kill, said Harsha Valia, a Canadian author and co-founder of the migrant justice movement, No One Is Illegal. All love and rage to the families of the migrants killed and injured in the migrant containment center in Juarez, part of the U.S. border outsourcing policies, will full complicity of Mexican governments.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program of Viewpoint. I'm Beta, the host of today's episode. And in today's discussion, we're going to discuss something about Zionism. At the episodes which we had in the last sessions, we talked about the importance of Palestine issue and so on. And according to that issue, we're going to discuss some more problems in cancer tumor in this area. And according to the leadership states, we have this beautiful quote that the Islamic Revolution announced that the Islamic Republic will support any nation and group that fights against the Zionist regime. And supporting this state, I want to ask this question. My dear brother Ali and brother Muhammad, welcome to
thank
this
you very much.
Episode. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Thank you.
Thank you. So let's go for the question of today's discussion. As I told you, we're talking about the importance of Palestinian issue for United States and Israel, and also the Zionist regime. What do you think about it? Why is it important for them? Brother Muhammad, let's start with you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The importance of Palestine, the area itself, for both the Zionists and the Americans is very clear for us, especially in the last few years. Considering that Palestine is now located in the center of all the Islamic countries in this area. And as we mentioned, the cancerous occupation that took place in Palestine was not only an occupation that had religious basis where the Jews would say, okay, this was this Mount Zion where the Prophet David or Prophet Dawood is buried, is you know, a sacred place for them, so they should return. It's more of a political movement where not only Jews now, but you know, Christians are also joining this movement. And even Jews who are godless, people who are atheists, Jewish or with a Jewish background, they also have the same mentality of getting back to this country. Now, this gives us the picture that it's not necessarily a religious movement. It's a movement that was much more political. And they had much bigger agenda than just to establish a Jewish government, considering the recent events that they have initiated. For example, the Daesh that they've initiated. We established this in the previous sessions as well. With the ISIS that they've established in the region, we understand that their goal is not only to establish a Jewish government.
Yeah.
It's much more than that. And it's to take control over the area, take control over the entire region. And not a control that is legitimate, but a control that is out of power and suppression.
Yeah,
that is that is the main reason and the importance of establishing an occupied territory for both the U.S. and the Zionist movement.
Yeah, thank you, Brother Muhammad and Brother Ali. Do you have anything to add to this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam Muhammad and his beautiful project. The reason that it was called the cancerous complex, and it was first coined by the late Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, it was due to three factors from the viewpoint of quality, quantity, and also the lands, or let's say the communities and lands which were in their vicinity, and they were in the verge of being violated. Look, what is a cancerous cell? The cancerous cell is something that is in a status of a disease that one cell actually grows more than the other cells.
Yeah.
Let's say, I mean, to make it in brief and let's say in simple words, it means that the other cells are not growing in their natural. The one cell is not growing in its natural order.
Yeah.
So when one cell actually is growing with a high speed, not in a natural order, so it is called a cancer disease. The same thing can be applied to this wicked entity. Because why? I mean, from the first point, they are greedily trying to actually expand the corruption in the region. And they are badly quick and fast in doing such a thing. I mean, this is from the viewpoint of quality. And from the viewpoint of quantity, I mean, if you look at every single aspect of their existence from the viewpoint of political, cultural, social, military, we see the kind of, let's say, corruption that is being generated from these aspects to the neighboring countries or even to the world. One might think that, okay, they are just dangerous for the neighboring countries, for the Palestine, I want to tell you that, no, they are even more dangerous for the non-Islamic countries. Look what they have done in Africa. What, I mean, with their expansion, what they have done in other countries. So this cancer actually is going to corrupt and ruin all the other cells in the body. If we consider the whole universe as a human body, so it is actually affecting this bad and, let's say, problematic cell actually is affecting every part of the body of the inhabitant of the earth. And from the third point, there are other lands which are under the danger of being conquered and being occupied by this regime, because they came with the motto and the slogan from Nile to Euphrates. You see, I mean, when they are coming with this, it means that they are considering from Africa till the West Asia. So it means it's really a huge part of the world is going to be conquered by them. So when I think this can be even rooted back in Quranic teachings that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, from these three from these three dimensions, actually refer to Yahud in Al-Quran, and the verses are available if we could have time. I mean, I can refer to those verses of Quran. And I want to say that what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said actually is due to one from medical teachings that it was called a cancer, and from the kind of, let's say, and from the other side, that is from the logical perspective, that it is there is a great logic behind it, and it is rooted in Quranic teachings. But you, at the beginning of your question, you mentioned something. I mean, you said that the importance of Palestine for America and Israel, if I'm not mistaken. Am I right?
Yeah, yeah.
So true. I want to say that Palestine is not important at all for Israel and for America. What is for the United States? What is important for them is the survival of, I mean, the state of Israel, the fake and forged state of Israel, not the Palestine. Because if Palestinian and Palestine was important to them, at least they could do something for the favor of Palestinians in the arena of international scenes. So, but we see that when we can even count more than 120 something times of massacres in different parts of this territory, that is in Palestinian lands, and no one says a word. I mean, by no one, I mean the so-called superpowers, when they are totally silent and they just do nothing, and they are not even ready to issue one article against the usurpation of Israel. So it means that it doesn't mean for them anything. I mean, it's not important for them at all. What is important is the survival of the fake Israeli regime, because as far as Israel is alive in the region, United States will be again available in the region, because it's a state, it's some sort of, let's say, tuning the existence and the availability of United States in the region. As far as it creates insecurity and unsafety for the region, there is a need for, let's say, provision of equipment, I don't know, military equipment, and this is the United States that is ready to provide such things, and the other superpowers.
All right. Thank you, Brother Ali, for your elaborations. We come to this point that, because of being cancerous of Israel and Zionist regime, it's good to know that we have to take a clear and precise position, about issues such as Palestine, Zionist regime, Syria, Iraq, everything. And supporting these, way of thinking, I have this question that we might think that Israel's goal is to dominate the vast, regions of Islamic countries. Yeah. So what could be the reason of this goal? Is it the real goal of Israel or not at first step? And then why do they have this goal?
Look, if they could, they have done it earlier because what is behind the plots of the Israeli regime and the supporters of this regime is not going to be limited to the land of Palestine. They wanted to start from somewhere, but they found the resistance of the Islamic Ummah to some extent. At the beginning, I mean, there were some six Islamic countries who stood in front of them, but later on, the front changed to the resistance line, I mean, till recently. But if they could, as I said earlier, they came with the motto of from Nile to Euphrates. So it's quite clear because this is a zeal and intention of the Israelis and let's say the Zionists. I can say better because I want to differentiate between Zionism and Judaism because I want to say this is a political party rather than a religion or the followers of a religion. So the Zionists. Actually, this is the nature of a Zionist to conquer and to extend and to expand his territory and to conquer the whole humanity under their own under their mastery. They believe that the religion that they have, they believe that no one can, unlike other religions, like, for example, Islam and Christianity, they believe that everyone should come and follow everyone should come and be a servant of them, and no one can enter the religion. Because in Islam, we believe that Islam is a global religion.
Yeah.
Christianity believes that it's a global religion. And it is open for anyone who can accept it and actually can. Islam and Christianity are welcoming both, the new followers. But you cannot see such a thing in Judaism. They believe that religion and religious beliefs are inherited generation by generation through blood, or let's say through mothers, or through some believe that through fathers.
Yeah.
So they believe that no one could be added to the number of the Jews that there are there. So, but they come, they believe that they have to take the leadership of the whole world, and all the inhabitants of the world should be the servants of these 2% of the population of the whole world to be at their service. So with this mentality, they want to bring the whole world under their own domination.
Thank you for your being here, for your presence in this episode and discussion. The pleasure was mine completely to host you. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. It was all the time we had for today's episode. I bid you farewell, and I leave you in the warm embrace of Allah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Father, to wipe away my tears, that's why I will cry. I feel scared, but I won't show my fears. I keep my head high, deep in my heart, I never have any doubt. The Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Black children are 6 times more likely on average to be strip searched by police in Britain. Nearly 3,000 children as young as 8 were strip searched from 2018 to 2022. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. Black children are 6 times more likely to be strip searched by police when compared with national population figures, an investigation has found. Almost 3,000 children as young as 8 were strip searched between 2018 and mid-2022, according to research from the Children's Commissioner. Of the 2,487 searches, 38% involved black children and more than half were carried out without an appropriate adult confirmed to be present. And in 45% of cases, police officers failed to record the location of the strip search, with some taking place in police vehicles and schools. Dame Rachel D'Souza, the Children's Commissioner for England, who began examining the issue following the search of the black schoolgirl named Child Q, said the findings made for disturbing but sadly not surprising reading. Child Q was 15 years old when she was strip searched in 2020 at her East London school while menstruating by police officers who believed she was concealing cannabis. Nothing was found and no further action was taken. Dame Rachel D'Souza said the new data combined with further statistics from the Metropolitan Police last year was the clearest indication that Child Q's experience was far from an isolated incident. I have severe concerns at the ethnic disproportionality shown in these figures. There is sustained attention on this issue not because of a police whistleblower or a government report, but thanks to the bravery of a 15-year-old girl in speaking up. Without her, these failures would have gone uncovered and unnoticed. We urgently need to strengthen guidelines around strip searches and to robustly challenge a culture that has allowed widespread failures to go unchallenged. The report comes a week after the Casey Review found multiple failings in the Metropolitan Police, including shocking examples of mistakes made when strip-searching children. Chief Constable Craig Guilford of the National Police Chiefs Council said it took all the concerns raised by the report seriously. The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. An official report accuses police of widespread abuse of their power to strip search children with black children 11 times more likely than their white peers to be selected by police officers for the ordeal. Data collected by the Children's Commissioner found there were at least 2,847 recorded strip searches of children pre-arrest across England and Wales between 2018 and 2022 under stop and search powers. The report released says 38% of children strip searched were black. Black children made up 5.9% of the population, meaning they were six times overrepresented. White children accounted for 42% of searchers and make up 74% of the population. The data was analysed for the Guardian by Dr. Christian Posh, a lecturer in crime science at University College London. It shows a black child in England and Wales was 11 times more likely to be strip searched than their white counterparts. The Children's Commissioner said the ethnic disproportionality was deeply concerning and utterly unacceptable, while the leader of the black police officers said it was another example of institutional racism which police leaders deny exists. Last week, a report by Louise Casey found the Metropolitan Police to be institutionally racist and riddled with discrimination that was baked in. The Children Commissioner's study found police did not follow the rules in more than half of strip searches, amounting to widespread non-compliance, and in half of all searches, nothing was found. 1 in 100 strip searches of children took place in public view, the report says, and 6% were conducted with a police officer present of a different gender to the child being searched. Appropriate adults were not present in 52% of cases. Of those strip searched, 95% were boys. 14 strip searches were conducted in police vehicles or schools. In 45% of cases, the location was not recorded. The youngest child strip search was just 8 years old. Last year, there was outrage over the case of Child Q, a 15-year-old schoolgirl in London, who, while on her period, was pulled out of class, told to spread, and was strip-searched. Inspector Andy George, the president of the National Black Police Association, said of the new report, "It is yet another example of institutional racism, which is adversely impacting children across England and Wales. Chief constables must be braver in acknowledging the existence of institutional racism if we ever hope to stop this cycle of low confidence with the black community. All children deserve protection and safeguarding. It is shocking that young black boys are so disproportionately subject to strip searches, often without an adult present. We hope that guidelines on strip searches can be tightened and the issue of racial disparity is taken seriously by all chief constables." One child who was strip-searched without an appropriate adult present said he felt humiliated by police officers. The Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, said, "I have severe concerns at the ethnic disproportionality shown in these figures and at the lack of appropriate protection for children during what is often a traumatic and humiliating experience." There is sustained attention on this issue, not because of a police whistleblower or a government report, but thanks to the bravery of a 15-year-old girl in speaking up. Without her, these failures would have gone uncovered and unnoticed. Rachel D'Souza added, "Across England and Wales, police are strip-searching children as part of stop-and-searches, and there is evidence of deeply concerning practice. My findings include evidence of widespread non-compliance with the statutory safeguards in place to protect children, including the lack of appropriate adults in more than half of strip searches, and strip searches being conducted in schools, police vehicles, and within public view. I have serious concerns about the poor quality of record keeping, which makes transparency and scrutiny very difficult, and means that the numbers in this report may only be a minimum." Deborah Coles of the campaign group Inquest said, This is a state-sanctioned child abuse operating outside the law. Strip searches are deeply harmful and dehumanizing and inflict fear and humiliation. The extent of searches on black children reveals once again how racism is institutionalized in police culture and in policy and practice. This abusive and abhorrent practice must end. Abimbola Johnson, who chairs a race oversight board for the National Police Chiefs Council, said it joined other reports as further evidence of prejudice in policing. The repeated theme is a failure of the institution to use its powers lawfully, legitimately, and with a sense of humanity, especially when it interacts with the most vulnerable groups in black communities, she said. These findings present a challenge not only to police officers but also to the statutory agencies whose remit it is to act as a check and balance on policing. These include the Independent Office for Police Conduct, His Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary, the Home Office, and Police and Crime Commissioners. 39 forces across England and Wales provided figures, several did not. Police were unable to respond or offer an explanation about the racial disparity shown by this new data.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.